Welcome to Sestercast, the Orphan Black podcast. I'm Jean McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Kathy Campbell. Hey, Kathy, how are you doing?
Hi, Jean, doing great.
Are you excited about this podcast?
I am so excited, and not just because of the episode.
Yes, that's right. Today on Sestercast, we have our first guest, and that is Jason Snell, our fearless leader at the Incomparable Network. Hi, Jason.
Ooh. Hello. I am so happy to have been invited on for what I think I've told both of you before is my favorite episode of Orphan
Yes.
Black.
Well, yes, that we did know that, and we thought this would be a perfect time to have Jason to come on as a guest and get another viewpoint on Orphan Black, provided that you don't give any spoilers, because this is a podcast in which one of us, Kathy, has not watched all of Orphan Black, so she's only up to episode 6. But we can count on you, Jason, to know where this episode ends and not go beyond.
Yes. I will be careful.
Now, just for the listeners who aren't Incomparable Network fans, maybe you could tell them a little bit about you.
Sure. I career-wise, I was the lead editor at Macworld, writing about Apple for more than a decade, and have been writing about tech stuff for about 25 years. And I do sixcolors.com, which is my site, and also links to all the freelance stuff I do. And then on the podcast side, I do a lot of tech podcasts at Relay FM. And I started the Incomparable podcast about 7 years ago, and it's turned into a network with many different podcasts from people I know and like, and they make cool podcasts that I'm not even always remotely involved with, and this is one of them. But now here I am, so I guess I'm now remotely involved.
We just had to get you in here somehow.
It's a stamp. It's just like the stamp of incomparableness that I, yes. Now you may proceed, and no one can ask why. It's obvious now.
So, can you tell us a little bit? Have you been an Orphan Black fan since it first started airing?
Yeah, I watched it. I watched it when it aired, and and so I had forgotten. I have not revisited the show at all, so I had forgotten how much happens in this episode and how much happens early on in the show, that 6 episodes in, all of these things are happening. I'm like, wow, I had no idea that this all happened in the first 6 episodes, because I had sort of remembered it as being kind of like, well, these are things that happened in the first year or two. And it turns out that they accelerated the storyline very quickly off the starting block. So, yeah, so I watched the first, I'm going to say I watched the first 2 seasons more or less live. I think season 3 piled up on my DVR. And so I'm actually a little behind. I haven't seen all of the aired episodes yet. I am behind on my Orphan Black, but I'm ahead of Kathy. So that's okay.
Yeah. It's not hard to be. It was really hard to stop after this episode. And like I was telling Jean earlier, it's restricting me to pay attention on the current episode that we're watching. And so I'm really enjoying the forced watching of one episode at a time.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun.
I mean, sometimes discipline is a good thing. Let's admit it. And I'm having to apply some discipline, because I would have watched episode 7 as well if I wasn't trying to keep also pace with Kathy's watching, keep my rewatching on that schedule. It will be hard going forward for me as well. Also, as Jason says, you forget exactly what happened even in the first season. It's quite mind-boggling how far along they get, and especially this episode, which pulls together a lot of strings that have been out there since episode 1. And I think let's just dive into it. The opening scene, we're set at the Hendrix's home, Allison and Donnie, and Donnie's snoring in bed. Allison wakes up, and we know from the previous episode Allison suspects Donnie of spying on her, and she's bought some surveillance equipment. So she's set up this nanny cam, or I think we'll call it the Donnie cam. And the Donnie cam is, she grabs it and goes down to her craft room, which is Allison's particular lair, which we love, especially Kathy, because Kathy's very crafty.
Yes.
And we're jealous of all the things she has in that room. And she watches on her computer. She reruns the recording from the night before and finds out, well, sure enough, Donnie got up in the middle of the night, stumbled over to her side of the bed, made sure she was still asleep, and then left. And the memory card ran out before she could see exactly when he came back, but he was gone for quite a while. And that sets up my favorite bit of the show where Donnie is cranky. He's in the kitchen.
He's so grumpy.
And he's complaining about Allison not having done all of her usual things that Allison would take care of, going shopping for a potluck party they're having that day, that, you know, there's no ice, there's no gift bags, the dishes mm-hmm. aren't clean. And it's really funny to see him complaining about the housework because we're pretty sure he does none of it normally. He says, all right, that's it. I'm going out shopping. I need to get ice plus everything you didn't pick up yesterday. And maybe Kathy, you want to finish out the scene because I will shriek probably.
Yeah. So he's just so frustrated. Do I have to do everything around here? And I'm just rolling my eyes while I'm watching this because he obviously is that kind of stereotypical father, husband, person in a sitcom type of a thing. And he's just like, fine, frustrated. He's getting to the door. And Allison almost, she gets these crazy eyes. And then she grabs the golf club and you're like, yep, she's going there. And just clocks him upside the head. And I was just like, what?
Yeah, I think in Orphan Black tradition, it's one of their killer cold opens because we weren't really expecting that. And she does say, I'm trying to have a conversation with you, Donnie. And he's just pissed off and he's like, it's fine. Don't worry. I'm sure we'll talk about it later. It's all good. And then
it's such a weird moment because, you know, we're with her in this paranoia about him being her observer or whatever he is. And because she's obviously the one who's always got this together, and he's complaining that she doesn't have it together is right. So ludicrous. But so it really feels like he's putting it on and he's trying to deceive her. And so I feel like we all get kind of caught up in that paranoid moment. But you're right. This is this whole episode, and it's one of the reasons I love it, is every time you think like, yeah, but they're not going to do that. And they totally do that.
Yeah. And then they do it.
It's true. So, yeah, so we're pretty shocked by that golf club moment. And I do like to point out that one of Donnie's first lines in this whole series was Allison asking him if he could watch the kids while she did something with her clone sisters. And he said, I've got golf. You know, so golf is representative. It's symbolic of Donnie's inattention to Allison's needs.
Right.
One thing on this podcast, Jason, you've probably noticed, we have a hard time keeping our first names straight because there's so many names of major characters, all played by the same actress, and then sometimes they're playing each other or impersonating each other. So I've been saying Beth a lot for Sarah. I have them very linked in my mind.
Sarah's playing Beth, right? So that makes sense. It is hard. They all look a little bit alike, but you know, it's
a little bit. Something about the nose, you know,
features.
The eyes,
a little bit,
right?
Yeah.
Just a little bit, but in general, I think Kathy and I have talked about this before. Is when we're watching it, I totally forget that it's the same actress. Most of the time, because it feels like different people, and our brains are wired to think they're different people, because how could two people be the same person talking to each other?
Just for this very episode, I thought to myself about how this is a great episode because I love Allison, and this is a great episode because Allison's in it a lot, and I have to think like but it's still all just the same actress. But I had that moment, and occasionally, and this is not really much of a spoiler, but in some future episodes, there are episodes where you know, we've spent a lot of time with Allison and Sarah and Cosima. There are some episodes where like one of them doesn't really appear, and I find myself doing that TV viewer thing where you're like, oh, I guess they must have given her the week off, and then I'm like, but no, because it's all the same actress again. It comes back to that, and that's the brilliance of this show.
Yes, she got the week off. She got the week off, and that she only had to play two characters instead of six.
Yeah, she didn't
have
to put it in the fake nose ring that week. So, you know, good for her.
Or where the I can just imagine the dreads wig has got to be hardcore and heavy.
Yeah.
Like, it's just got to, it just seems like it has so much weight to it with all the braids that it just makes my head ache.
But yeah, so speaking of Beth, the next scene opens in Beth's apartment, and it's the other major string that's going to be followed through this episode. It's Paul and Sarah at Beth's place. And at the end of the last episode, Sarah admitted that she was Sarah, not Beth, and that Beth was dead. And actually, the ending of that episode was very dramatic, because then Sarah asks him, why are you doing this? Why are you watching Beth? And he says, they don't tell us why. So we know Paul's not in the loop as much as you might think he is. So this is a bit of backstory there, where Paul tells her, well, he's basically being blackmailed to do this job because he did something when he was some private contractor for the military, some mercenary bad deed that he did that they can hold over him and ask him to monitor Beth for 2 years. So that was the contract.
And especially because of his military history, he has these special skills that,
right,
you know, they picked him for a reason, because they knew that he could keep up with a cop. It would be much more difficult to have a monitor over Beth versus, like, Allison, which is what we're led to believe this episode. Allison also is married or sleeping with her monitor. So it wouldn't necessarily need a hardcore military mind to keep an eye on Allison.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So at this point, Paul thinks that Sarah is Beth's twin sister. That's what Sarah told him. That's the extent of what she told him. And he said, you know, they talk about how they have both been playing a role. He says, we need to be honest with each other, twin sister. And she says, sure, I'm going to go take a shower. And then she escapes out the back window. So she's not being very trustworthy from Paul's point of view.
Such a pro move that I love it. She turns on the shower. She's taken off her clothes. The doors are all open. So it's like,
right,
she is sending all the signals to him that she basically trusts him to a certain degree, and that he can see everything that's going on. Even though she's revealed to be kind of a stranger to him, she's still comfortable taking off her clothes in front of him. The shower is running. She's very definitely coming right back, because what crazy person would turn on the shower and then not go back and get in it? And then she's just gone. It's so great.
She's just... Yeah, especially because you can just see his face, and the guy that plays Paul is just like fantastic with his facial expressions. But you can just see he has this, he's like, okay, I'm waiting. And then it's just oh no.
Well, I'm filing this away in my notebook of Sarah tricks that I have learned from watching Orphan Black. And one is drinking soap in the bathroom if I need to get out of an interview. And now... the other is to pretend like I'm taking a shower and sneak out that way, where I put myself as if I'm vulnerable. So not that I really need these tricks in real life, but you never know. So then Sarah's on the phone with Cosima and says, hey, you were right. Paul doesn't know about the clones. And Cosima is herself very sheepishly smiling at Delphine, the fellow graduate student she met last week, a French graduate student in biology, and she says, I might have a monitor dilemma of my own, to put it mildly. And Sarah's like, stay away, you know, Paul's badass, and you should watch out, you know, stay clear. And Cosima's like, oh, the old do as I say, not as I do. So Cosima's a little miffed that Sarah's trying to tell her what to do, and, you know, reverse psychology, this is not going to turn out well.
Right. Especially because you can tell that Cosima is kind of getting settled into the fact that, oh, she knows she has a monitor. She knows who it is. So she's going to try and walk into the trap to trigger it, but be aware of it type of a whole, like, complicated, oh, I'm fine.
Yeah.
But it's unsure as to how.
No, I think that's fine. Right. Yeah. She knows. She feels like she can handle her situation. Plus, there's the added enticement of this very smart A+ French graduate student who she'd like to hang out with. So Yep. So now we're back at the Hendrix's house where Allison has called Sarah and says, get over here now. I need you. She doesn't even explain why. And Sarah's like, okay, I'm going, which she owes her. She owes her a favor. So she from the previous episode where Allison pretended to be Sarah for Sarah's benefit. And she sends her kids out to the neighbor's house and tries to move Donnie. I don't know how she thought she was going to do this, but poor Donnie. It's amazing he's still alive because she basically dumped him down the stairs, right?
She put a helmet on him at least.
Oh, right, and then threw him down the stairs.
And I was just like, oh, that looks like it hurts. But little did I know that that would be the smallest pain that would happen.
Well, yes, we're getting to that. But yeah, a real mom move there to put the helmet on. so back to Beth's apartment where Paul is, of course, he's got a tracking device on Sarah. And it's one of our first moments where you think, come on, Sarah, what do you think is going to happen? Yeah. He's not going to know where you go. But now I think we go to the heart of this episode and why people like it so much, which is kind of a sad commentary on why what we like in Orphan Black. But Allison is tying Donnie up to a chair in her crafts room, and she's got him blindfolded and gagged and... Yes.
In the best way. In a very Allison way.
Jason's laughing with glee, which is making his stock in my eyes actually go
up. This is peak Allison. This is Allison being as Allison as she can be to this extreme, which is why I love it. She's in the they're in the craft room. She's got her glue gun. She's got him tied up. This is like, how do you take this this super intense suburban housewife? We know already, super intense. And then you make her paranoid. You introduce her to these twins of hers. So she's like, who am I? So you've pushed her as far as you maybe can push her. Like she's now like, what does she do? And what are the tools in her arsenal? And so it's, it ends up being interrogation in the craft room. And I love it. I love that she gets pushed to this level and that she fights back with the tools that are at her disposal. It's great. And I like Donnie sort of like, oh, God, because Donnie is such a humorous character that even in this intense scene where you should be feeling sorry for Donnie, it's also just really funny that he is, because he just doesn't understand what's happening here while she is super paranoid. It's great.
Yeah. He was not expecting this, to put it mildly. And I like how she spins around the scissor holder. So she has many types of craft scissors.
Many scissors with different colored handles.
Handles. Yes,
in a caddy.
And the reason those are different colors is because the scissor pattern is different.
Yes.
So you have, like, you can cut pretty designs in paper. And so you can tell that she has used these supplies often.
Yes.
And she's very familiar with them.
And now they're her tormented tools.
And she goes, don't worry, honey. It's all good. Isn't that what you always tell me? And she just has those crazy eyes again.
Yeah.
And I put a note, especially in this bit, where she's like, Tatiana is playing Allison with a different kind of crazy, because we'd seen her with, oh my gosh, I just blanked the angel.
With Helena. Oh,
yeah. Helena. We saw her play Helena as crazy, like legit insane. And now we have her playing Allison as Allison with, who's gone off the deep end. Like she's losing her mind. She's past the point of any sort of sanity right now. And they're very different ways of playing crazy. And it's just mind blowing how incredible the acting is in this scene.
It's not fair to just talk about Tatiana Maslany as you know, oh, she has multiple roles. She plays different characters, because this show and this episode shows it, right? She is playing different,
yes,
like really different levels of, in this case, emotional affect of these characters. And then, as yes, we're about to see, she's also playing these characters' interpretations of the other characters, which is the trickiest,
yes,
of things. But you're right, the crazy eyes, this is we're Allison's a fully realized character, and we're seeing all of her like worst instincts coming out with the crazy eyes right,
yes,
here.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a couple of great lines in this scene, which I don't want to gloss over. So she puts down the scissors, picks up the glue gun, and says, "Isn't there something you want to get off your chest?" Which is in itself is painful. And he says, "Or what? You're going to stick sequins on me?"
And laughed so hard with that, because you could tell he's just like, she's not really gonna do this, she's not really going to burn me with, you know, this, yeah, is my wife, I love her, and then she, yeah, does,
yeah, which I think it's an accident, the first glue drip. She seems pretty surprised. She puts her hand over the mouth,
yeah,
and like he's screaming. I don't know,
yeah,
she did pull out the glue gun, so she knows
she could. Yeah, she was threatening him though, and then I do think that's accidental, and then she gets kind of this feeling of, oh, let's do more of that. That actually works for me. Although,
right,
I think one of the things that is notable, I think, about Donnie in general, is that they wanted him, you know, they want to portray him as being this kind of clueless guy, but they also want there to be an edge of dismissiveness toward her. He doesn't take her seriously. And
right,
I think that we saw that earlier where he's talking to her about like, oh, you didn't do all these things, I have to do them now. We've seen it before when he talks about going to play golf or whatever. And here it's, you know, he doesn't believe that she's capable of any of this. And he is just, even in this moment, he's dismissive of her. And that's, I think, good for the audience, because,
yeah,
it makes us feel more like he kind of gets what he deserves a little bit, just a little bit.
Right.
Well, yeah, if you're going to watch a guy being burned with hot glue, it's nice if you feel like he deserves, mm-hmm, it.
Just a little, yeah.
A little. And then, yeah, I mean, besides the glue gun, then she has, you know, she starts, you know, really haranguing him about, I know what you do. You perform experiments on me in my sleep. You switch the files in your special box for porno DVDs. And then the brilliant, like, scene where she slaps him three times with each word for big slap, boob slap, blowies slap, and I just fell apart laughing with that that line. I think that must have been really fun to film. And then she lets more hot glue fall on his chest, so that's for big boob blowies, Donnie, get some. So as we know, Donnie's not getting out of that chair anytime soon, but no. The show does move on to Cosima and to the University of Minnesota, where she's in the library and she starts, comes over to Delphine and to flirt a bit with her, and says she's bored. Delphine says, we should go to this lecture, you know, if you want to come, and hands her the flyer. And when Cosima reads it, she's like, Neolutionism? Really? You know, and it's just kind of fringe. And Delphine thinks, like, says to her, well, I thought it would interest you, because this Dr. Leakey is really an interesting speaker. I saw his TED Talk. I just like that little bit, like Dr. Leakey
drop
would be on TED. Of course he would. And so Cosima,
yeah,
wants to hang out with Delphine, so she's like, sure, why not? But that's how Neolutionism is introduced, mm-hmm, into Orphan Black. And then a quick shot of Paul, where he's going through Beth's medicine closet. He's put gloves on. So in Orphan Black, putting on gloves is the universal symbol for you're doing something you shouldn't be doing. And he mixes a bunch of prescription medication into a bottle of whiskey, puts it back on the shelf, and calls Sarah to say, we need to talk. We still need to talk. And so we've seen the setup of the bottle that has presumably a very potent sleeping prescription in it. I actually did zoom in on the prescription bottle, or not zoom in, but I paused to try to read what it was. And it was some name of something that sounded like a mashup of other opioids. And I Googled it, and the only thing that came up was something from Orphan Black. So, and actually, the whiskey is as well as a made-up brand. I looked that up because I'm also interested in whiskey. Then the show goes back to the basement of torture, I mean of crafts, and Allison is still interrogating Donnie, and she's asking him why did he do it, he's acting as if he doesn't know what she's talking about. Am I sick like the German, she asks, and he's like, what German, who's German? And she's starting to threaten him with another glue gun shot. There's a knock at the door, and she blindfolds and gags him again, and then goes to answer the door, and it's Sarah. So this is pretty funny, because now Sarah's, Allison's like, you better sit down for this. And she opens up the door to the crafts room to reveal Donnie all tied up and gagged. And Allison says, I think he's my watcher. And Sarah's pretty taken aback because this is crazy pants. Mm. Meanwhile, there's a whole party starting upstairs. And Ainsley, Allison's very good friend and neighbor, is shouting, you know, hello, what's happening? And Sarah's got this horrified, like, what the hell is that? This party, this potluck that is supposed to be happening at Allison's house, just seems like the nightmare of all parties, even if it was going well. That these neighbors do this every month seems like, yes, there's a reason why Felix refers to this neighborhood as Scarberia.
I love the suggestion that the show has, that even though Allison is living such a different life from Sarah or Beth, that Allison, you know, has her own like weird horror world. It's just the, yes. the terms are different, and the stakes may be a little bit different, but she's got, you know, she has enemies what's her name? Ainsley. She's got enemies, and there's drama, and she's, you know, got a battle for things with her, you know, with her kids and doing things with the kids and keeping up appearances and fighting with her husband. And that's one of the things that I like about the show, is that it's doing some social commentary here, but I think it's also making some really interesting parallels in saying, like even though Allison's living a very different life from Sarah, Allison is the same person as Sarah, and her life is just as complicated as Sarah's, but with all the all the terms changed. But in the end, it's a very similar kind of stressful, dangerous life full of enemies and dangers. It's just they're just defined differently, and I like that about all the kind of suburb scenes with Allison. It's one of the reasons I like Allison.
Yeah, I agree.
Actually, in this watching this, whatever my third or fourth time, I was more impressed with Ainsley as an actress, the woman who plays her, because she really has a hard role to play, where she's supposed to be such a cutout character, but there is something a little bit sympathetic about her as well.
Yeah, I feel like if you look at her through the eyes, not of the show, but of reality, everything she does is perfectly reasonable. This is banana pants stuff going on, right? So she should be like, what are you doing? Why are you behaving this way? She is upset about her husband. She is wondering what is going on with Allison. It's not unreasonable, but when you see it through the super paranoid lens and drugged up lens of Allison, she seems like this enemy.
Right.
But I'm not sure. I mean, she may be kind of a frenemy kind of person, but her reactions aren't bizarre or anything.
Especially I'm thinking of later on in the shed when she's just like, but I put you to bed, like this whole, and we'll get there. And like, she's just trying to figure out maybe if she's crazy, like has she gone insane? You just sympathize with her if you can look at it you know, subjectively that, mm-hmm. oh, she's not the bad guy necessarily. This is kind of how anyone would react and what they would do.
Right, right. And she is the one who says to Allison, now just take some of your happy pills and let's get this yes. party started. So that's when things really start going south for Allison in particular. She asks Sarah to pretend to be her, and so that Sarah should pretend to be Allison and continue interrogating Donnie and find out the truth while Allison tries to slap together this potluck party. So, I mean, it can only get crazier from this moment. And the fact that they you know, have so many things going on at once, but yet it all seems to make sense, and it all fits into 43 minutes. Shows you the control the script writers and the directors have on this this crazy story. But yeah, so at this point now you've got Allison tying off a sign saying the basement's off limits, and Sarah is trying to tell her to get rid of everyone, but she says, I can't back out of the monthly potluck, which I love. You know, she can't tie up her husband and burn him with a glue gun, but she can't back out of the monthly potluck. Of course, this is when Sarah calls Felix and says, can you come over and bartend? And Felix is otherwise engaged, but he says, okay. And Sarah says, dress suburban and don't forget the ice. And I love how ice is just like, this is the key factor of this whole party, because of course there have to be drinks. They've been talking about ice since the first scene, and Felix is supposed to get the ice. Meanwhile, Allison is burning sausage rolls in the kitchen. Neighbors are asking where the kids' gift bags are, which I'm like, really? You have to do this every month potluck thing, and you have to have gift bags for the kids? That takes us to Sarah's getting ready also to impersonate Allison, and she puts on lipstick and she puts on a big headband. And she's gonna interrogate him. But before we get to that, there's a scene of Paul and Olivier, who we met in the last episode, who is Paul's boss. Paul is telling Olivier that Beth is actually not doing fine. She's right back in her dark place, despite the fact that the day before he was telling Olivier that Beth was fine. And Olivia says, well, you know, just don't interfere unless it's critical. And Paul is saying to Olivier, I need to know. I won't be blamed if she tries it again. So apparently Beth did try to commit suicide before with an overdose. And I realized for the first time watching it this time, oh, I get it. He's planning to potentially kill Sarah with these pills and
exactly.
the whiskey. And he was setting up his alibi in advance. So now we're back in the torture basement, torture crafts room, and now it's Sarah who's interrogating Donnie. Sarah's not paranoid. She's not really convinced at all that Donnie is the monitor, but he starts yelling at her, thinking she's Allison, of course, and is, take off the GD blindfold. And then he hears, like, you know, the noise from the parties, like, what? The whole neighborhood is here? What kind of irrational nonsense is going through that head of yours? Ooh, that just even saying that out loud makes my blood pressure go up when somebody says that head of yours. That's, as Sarah does say, watch your tone. Donnie says, get your frazzled PMS shit together. Oops. Donnie said that, not me. Sarah takes off the blindfold. So up until this point, she's left the blindfold on maybe to give herself some leeway to not be the perfect Allison impersonator. But she's mad now. Mm. And she rips off the blindfold and she says, you watch your tone. Your wife is the rock of this family. You will no longer speak down to her. Am I clear? Ooh.
I love it that as Allison, Sarah is defending Allison. It's wonderful. It's one of my favorite things in this episode.
Yes. Yeah. Especially because they were so antagonistic to each other at the beginning of the series that seeing Sarah take this ownership of Allison and realize, hey, Allison doesn't have the perfect life. And seeing how much Allison has put up with in the past and being able to confront Donnie as Allison, because how dare Donnie say those things to about his mm-hmm. wife. Like, how dare he? Yeah. Especially when he was getting up to watch cricket in the middle of the night.
Like, yeah. So they go back to Delphine and Cosima. They're there to see Dr. Leakey give his talk on Neolution. And Cosima noticed some weird people standing around with one white eye and weird hair. And Delphine's saying, like, no, Dr. Leakey attracts diverse thinkers.
Right.
And his presentation starts up, and he basically at the end of which he says, you know, Neolution gives us an evolutionary choice, not just a choice, but a human right. Wearing glasses or fixing something in your body is self-directed evolution, and we have the right to do that sort of thing.
So I love Matt Frewer. I love Max Headroom.
Yes.
I love other stuff he's in. I enjoy him here. I think he's doing the Matt Frewer thing, which he does really well. I am a little bit frustrated by the fact that I can't decide whether I like it or not, that this Neolutionism thing is like really vague. Like, it sounds like what he's really saying is sort of that he believes in the future, like technological augmentation or maybe biological augmentation of human beings. But it's super squishy. And I've always felt like this was one of the problems with the show when it was talking about, when we have Matt Frewer here talking about Neolutionism, is like, what does that mean? And what is it really about? And I feel like they don't want to commit too much. They want it to be kind of hazy and let's not bring in like science or anything. Really, let's just leave it as a super vague TED talk and move on with the story. And the problem with that is that when you then have characters talking about Neolutionists and Dr. Leakey and his group, we're meant to sort of just view them as an object of like, there are these people, but I never really get a sense. And I feel like here they kind of whiff at like really defining what they believe in. Cause I think they don't want to, but I think it hurts them.
I do think that the way it's defined, if we could call that at all, then everybody we see even today with tattoos and all sorts of piercings and all of that is a Neolutionist or a freaky Leakey. And that is way too broad of a definition.
And without spoiling Kathy or anybody else who hasn't seen the rest of the series, I would just say that there are a few different kind of philosophical views that come up in the series that are trying to kind of relate to how the world in the secret world of Orphan Black sees these clones and where the clones are from and where they're going. And, you know, just in the world building, we do meet a few different people and their philosophical views of humanity and human evolution and all those things. And one of them is Leakey's Neolutionist. And like, if you're going to have different groups with different philosophies, I feel like you need to do some extra work to very clearly define like who they are and what they believe in. And at the time when I watched this episode, I was like, okay, I don't really get it, but it's Matt Frewer and I'm very happy. Having seen more episodes of Orphan Black, I look at the speech and I'm happy to see Matt Frewer, but I'm also kind of angry because they should have done a better job of defining what these people mean. And I don't think they do it as good a job as they should. I should have a much more tangible feeling, but instead it's more like it's kind of a cult of personality and it's weird and that's all we need to know. And if that was truly all we needed to know, I'd be okay with it. But we guess what? No major spoilers here. Matt Frewer is not just in this episode, right? Like at the end of this episode makes clear we're going to see more of him. And yeah. I think it lets him down a little bit to be so vague with it. He does a great job with his vague TED talk, and it makes me laugh because it's kind of funny that it's a vague TED talk, but still.
The next thing we see is Felix getting out of a cab, and he's dressed all preppy. I love that.
He
that
looks
getup.
Fabulous.
I don't know about you, Jason, but Felix is pretty much our favorite member of Clone Club right now.
Well, Felix is a great character. I love everything about Felix. I love his, well, do I love everything about Felix? I like lots of things about Felix, including, I'm not going to do a blanket statement. I have some complaints about him, but in general, I love that he's a confidant. And what I really love is that he is, and he's very funny. He's got his own point of view, but I love how he gets integrated into the family. Like he's everybody's brother, basically, and that he gets to meet the other, you know, he gets to see Allison's life, and that's hilarious to me that he's seeing his friends' like alternate lives as he goes. It's great, and he's great here, right? Because he's a little bit like, we're gonna get this together. I'm gonna run the bar, and you know, the party's fine now. Everybody, Felix is here to save it. Hilarious. Yeah.
Well, especially he brought the ice, so you know the party's saved.
Right. So the ice has shown up. Felix has shown up. He escorts Allison downstairs because she is definitely wasted on pills and white wine. And so Allison's talking to Sarah about her interrogation of Donnie, and she said, "I screwed up. It's not him, is it? I tortured my husband. I screwed up my family. I'm a horrible person. I'm not even a real person." She says, like, "Look, Paul's military, you know. Donnie says he got up in the middle of the night to watch cricket. I mean, you've known Donnie since when?" And Allison says, "High school." And Sarah's like, "Right, high school. So how could he be your monitor?" And then Allison says, "So he's just Donnie? Eating, farting, Donnie." I love that. And then she says, "My monitor's probably one of those bitches upstairs." And then she promptly passes out. At this point, we also see that Paul is parked outside the Hendricks house and watching people go inside for the potluck. And he's got to be thinking, what the hell is, what did I get myself into? And
why is Sarah here?
Why is Sarah here? He gets out of the car. I love again. He pulls on the black gloves of evil intent. And he looks actually kind of dorky at that point. I think that's the only time he doesn't look that good. It's like, why is this dude in a leather jacket and black gloves walking down in broad daylight in the middle of suburbia? Then the next person who shows up. So Paul's going in through the back gate of Allison's house. And Felix is upstairs running the party. And he turns around and there's Vic. We saw at the end of the last episode, he got very badly wounded by Pouchy, the drug dealer, and he's lost a finger. He says he has unfinished business with Allison. So Felix calls Sarah and says, "You've got to come upstairs right now. Vic is here." And Vic is saying, "If you don't come upstairs right now, I'm going to start making friends real fast." So Sarah says, "Well, let's just meet upstairs in the second floor bedroom, 2 minutes." So Vic is on his way upstairs. Paul is in the basement. First, he sees Allison passed out on the couch, and he doesn't know who she is. First, he calls her Beth, and then he looks for the scar on her neck, and he says, "No scar." And then he says, "Sarah," and she says, "No, Allison." And he hears a crash in the crash room, and that's Donnie, who's probably been trying to get out of his chair and knocks himself over. And I love how he comes in there, and he looks at Donnie, but Donnie doesn't even know he's there because he's Paul. He's Mr. Stealthy Military Guy, and he's not there to help Donnie at all.
No.
He's there to figure out what's going on. And he sees the feed from the nanny cam.
Because, of course, it's still on and filming.
So he can see there's Vic sitting on the bed and Sarah coming in to talk to Vic. So within, like, 2 minutes of being in this house, he's got so many new pieces of information about Sarah. It's got to be pretty mind-boggling. So Vic upstairs is talking to Sarah, saying, "We have unfinished business. You faked your own death so you could move along to a new scam. Where are you now, Sarah? This must be so confusing." And Sarah says, "You have no idea." "5 measly grand," says Vic. "It's not enough for my pain and suffering. I want a cut of this new scam." So Paul's been watching all this, so now he walks upstairs into the room, and Vic is like, "Hey, wrong room, pal." And Paul says, you must be Vic." And Sarah's like, "Uh-oh. This is none of your business," Sarah says. And Paul gets, like, really an aggressive tone towards her of, like, "Am I talking to you?" Paul is the person who knows the most in this particular. He doesn't know about the clones, but he knows something about Vic and Sarah doesn't know what Paul knows, and Vic is definitely out of the loop. Paul is now pretending like he's Sarah's handler, and he wants to get information out of Vic about Sarah. So he's like, "What's she done this time?" And Vic says, "Oh, Sarah." Sarah and Paul says, "Hey, she works for me. You talk to me." And Vic says, "Oh, yeah, is that right?" And he pulls out a gun. And everybody at this point is like, oh, really? Vic is going to pull one over on Paul.
He's not the most intimidating of people when compared to Paul, who very obviously can kick his butt.
Yeah.
Even with a gun.
So Paul's smiling, and he suggests that they should leave the bedroom before somebody else walks in. That they're, you know, he implies they're in the middle of some kind of scam, and if he wants to talk about it, let's go out to the garage. So the three of them are starting to walk out of the bedroom, and when Sarah opens the door, there's Ainsley. Ainsley shows up. And she's like, we need to talk. And Vic says, you can talk inside the bedroom. We can handle this ourselves. And Vic and Paul leave without Sarah to go down to the garage. And Ainsley is, of course, her curiosity's totally piqued. Here's two men she's never seen before in Sarah's bedroom. And I'm sorry, in Allison's bedroom.
With the door closed.
Ainsley has come up to talk about Chad, her oaf of a husband, which we've already seen him downstairs pinching Allison's butt and being a jerk. One of the things I loved in this scene in particular is the way they have the camera set up. So there's sometimes where Sarah is facing Ainsley and she has to have her Allison face on. She pretty much has her Allison face on, but as soon as she's looking away, she's giving the camera the Sarah face of like, oh my God, I can't believe I have to deal with this woman. So then things get pretty exciting down in the garage when Paul and Vic get down there.
Because, of course, Paul kicks Vic's butt and takes control. Right. Once he's in the space, he's in a safe space, so he won't be hurting Sarah.
Yeah.
They're in a safe space, and now he has control. And he pulls out the nail gun to threaten, which is way more scary than a gun.
Or a glue gun. Glue gun.
Or a glue gun, yeah.
But, yeah, that's true. You have the three different kinds of guns in this episode, and they're all kind of scary, depending on who's wielding it. But, boy, Paul, I thought, like, he has a gun, right? He has Vic's gun. Why does he want to pull out a nail gun except for the sheer psychological torture of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's gonna do that. So one of the things I love about this, and you mentioned the different layers of the guns, is I had my theory earlier, right, about how Allison is living her version of Sarah's life and it's still got threats and enemies and things like that. One of the things I love about the different guns is it's the same sort of thing. And really one of the reasons I love this episode is that you've got all these different levels. You've got Sarah's life, you've got Beth's life with Paul, and you've got Allison's life, and they're all clashing at this party in the garage. And I just love how that all gets mixed up together, that you've got kids coming in and you've got Ainsley coming in, and it's all mixed up. It's farce, essentially. It's a farce structure, except because of the paranoia and the violence and the threat of violence, it's not played as the same kind of a farce, but it is a farce structure of people misunderstanding and going in and out of rooms and things like that. And I think they do a pretty good job of keeping all of the plates spinning as they're moving the characters around through these situations.
Yes, I agree.
Well, and it has that farcical, you know, if you were to write it down and say, oh, this person's pretending to be this person and oh, comedy of errors and people are coming in and out and whatnot, but it doesn't, it's not humorous. It's very serious and you're keeping, so no matter how farcical the whole, hey, you were upstairs and not actually passed out and all of this, you're not laughing at any of it.
Because he's got, I laugh some, but it's a different kind of feeling when he's got a gun or there's going to be, somebody's going to get their hand nail gunned to a chair or something like that, right? It's the tension is like a violent tension instead of a sexual tension, which is a really interesting kind of flipping of the farce structure. And I think it's really great.
And we already learned from last episode that, you know, somebody's finger could get cut off in a paper cutter, you know, violently, like, you know,
right.
So your tame household objects or your hardware, your tools can be turned into real torture items. And when he's holding that nail gun to Paul's, Paul is holding the nail gun to Vic's head, I'm thinking Vic has not had a good run this last couple episodes.
No.
And he might really,
really
get it. And he does. He gets the nail in the hand when he tries to get away. The next thing they show is Paul like kicking Vic out through the garage door and Sarah saying, you know, we're done, you know, never come back. And they close the garage door and Ainsley shows up behind them and Ainsley's thinking, I just saw Allison. She had helped passed out Allison, who was on the couch, up to bed. And then when she comes into the garage, I'm not sure why she goes to the garage, but she goes,
right.
I think because she's nosy. She sees Sarah as Allison and she's confused. And Sarah pretends to be Allison having an affair with Paul and says, this is just one of those secrets between consenting adults. And Ainsley says, yeah, you're right. None of my business. And that was interesting because was not expected from Ainsley. So,
well, especially because the reason that Sarah does this isn't to, you know, harm Allison's relationship with anyone or anything, but to distract and get it so that Paul doesn't shoot mm-hmm. her. Because he's reaching for the gun that he's put in
right.
his back, like
right.
tucked into the back of his pants. And so she's just like, oh, no, I can't let him shoot Ainsley because that would be
yeah.
bad.
So Vic's gone. Paul says, you know, time to go home. And then we have the last three scenes that wrap up these threads, starting with Allison and Donnie. Donnie's in bed. Allison comes into the bed and saying, you know, starting to apologize about my little breakdown, she says. And Donnie's like, no, no, it's my fault. You're right. You're the rock of the family. I'm so sorry. So in the end, it seems like Allison and Donnie have come to a higher level of understanding of their relationship and they're going to be okay.
He's not going to take her for granted given what she did. And then of course, what we got, Sarah to say to him as her,
right.
which he has taken to heart,
yeah.
right? That this is sort of like the interesting resolution of this is he has learned his lesson maybe about taking her
Hopefully.
For granted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course I'm guessing it will, there will be other bits in the future, but I'm really hoping that he will become a better husband and better father and better like helper around the house because of this situation. And if so, then it, I'm okay with the glue gun being used.
Okay. I hope your husband's not listening to this podcast. I know you have a glue gun.
I don't have one
okay.
anymore.
So it was confiscated.
yes.
but I know you have Fisker's scissors, craft scissors all over the place.
I have the scissors.
So. Meanwhile, back at Beth's apartment, Paul's pulled out the bottle he's put the drugs into and says to Sarah, drink. She says, yeah. I like this dialogue just because there's like five interactions where it's just one word. He says, drink. She says, yeah. He says, talk. She says, clones. He says, clones? Question mark. And then he pauses. When she says clones, he stops opening the bottle. So he puts the spiked bottle back up in the cabinet and brings down the other bottle.
Yeah. This is for not just for our benefit, but for her
yeah.
benefit. Like, because I don't know whether she would really buy that drink or not
mm-hmm.
from him. But what he does is he puts it back very clearly, takes the other bottle down. And then what he does is drink from it and hand it to
yeah.
her, which I felt
yes.
was him... unsaid, sending a signal that it's safe.
Yeah.
Right.
Because he drank from the bottle and is now just handing it to her. That it is safe.
Yeah.
And that, you know, forget that other bottle that you just saw.
Ignore this. It was a way of Paul to show his trust for this stranger. Look, let me prove that this is safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to hurt you. So that she can feel comfortable to keep talking.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we started off with this in this episode was that they need to trust each other if they're going to benefit from, you know, a relationship together, trying to figure out what is going on. And Paul is the first person in the series now, after Felix, who actually knows about the clones, outside of the clones themselves. So obviously, as the series goes on, more people will be in on the story. And I think it's interesting that this is the first relationship that has enough trust built into it where he gets brought into the picture.
Well, and it's that they're, the trust is built on this really weird foundation of sort of equally being betrayers, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Because she's not who she appears to be and he's not who he appears to be. But at that point when they find out that they're both playing a game, they've slept with each other. And so it's like, it's an interesting, it's almost like the act of coming clean is the thing that provides the trust. It's not that it started with deceptive actions, but now they've both, you know, kind of said who they are. I think that's really interesting. I also think I think Paul's a really interesting character because he's our connection mm-hmm. with Beth. And so he is obviously working through like feelings of there's a woman who looks just like Beth, but it's not Beth, and Beth killed herself, and he was supposed to be watching Beth and protecting her, and he failed. Like all of that is mixed up in their relationship too. It's just, it's one of the rich, one of the things I love about Orphan Black is that they have this very, in some ways it could be treated simply, a premise that, oh, there are a bunch of women who look exactly the same and are played by the same actress because they're clones. But when you start to unravel it, you get to these really interesting layers of not just they all live in worlds that are similar but different, like I said earlier, but also in like something like with Paul, where he's now meeting somebody who looks just like his dead girlfriend, and she, you know, but she's not. And like, what does that all mean? And it's all really interesting. That's the kind of the rich layer underneath this whole show that I really appreciate.
Especially because Paul has now become not the enemy necessarily. I mean, they've both been ultimately duped by whoever is making the clones, you know.
Right.
He's not the enemy anymore. And then the very final scene just really emphasizes he's not the enemy anymore.
That last scene is very simple. Fancy hotel room. Fancy high heels walking into a hotel corridor, opening a door, and we see it's Delphine. She's just dressed to the nines. She enters the room, and then Dr. Leakey's in the room behind her, greets her in French, slides his hands over his shoulders, kisses her neck, and that's the end. So we got things somewhat straightened out with Paul, but boy, what about Delphine?
And Dr. Leakey, because obviously Dr. Leakey has got to have something to do with this.
Yeah.
It was fairly obvious before you see that they actually know each other and are together, but the fact that they're in a hotel room together is like, okay, how connected is Dr. Leakey with whoever made the clones in the first place?
The thought I had with this scene is just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you. Like,
yes.
We've gone through this whole episode of like, really? I mean, yeah, there's this woman who's following her around, but that doesn't necessarily mean that she's her watcher. It could be fine. Like, let's go to the Leakey thing. And now you see this and you're like, oh, this was all a setup. She's in their trap. And so just when you're thinking like, oh, of course, you know, Paul is understanding what's going on, and you know, we realize that that Donnie is you know, it's silly to suspect Donnie, and that was just paranoia. And then we get this moment of like, boom! But there's actually a conspiracy happening
right
in front of you all along.
Yes,
another satisfying episode of Orphan Black, as long as you don't define satisfying as like not needing to watch another episode.
Finishing anything. Yeah, I am both dreading and excited for the season finale if these types of like cliffhangers are happening in regular episodes, like I can only imagine the end of a season. And I'm just very thankful that I don't have to wait a full summer or however long the months before it started again.
That's right.
Because we can just go to the next episode.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us. We really enjoyed having you here to talk over Orphan Black with us.
Thank you for having me. I do love this episode, as I love all things Allison, especially. And and thank you for not going through with all of your threats involving that glue gun.
All right. And Kathy, you have a good week. We'll catch up on the next episode of Orphan Black.
It's not going to have as much hype now that I know that it's not Jason's favorite episode.
Did it live up to it? Was it good? Did it live up to it?
Absolutely. It was fantastic. But I was scared that I wasn't going to love it as much as you did.
This is an unusual episode in the fact that it is this totally nuts farce that happens at that party. Like they don't do episodes like this that often. But that's the thing that pushes it over the top for me. So they'll be back to a more normal episode next week.
Good, because this was exhausting. Yeah.
Why don't you let people know where they can find us?
Yes, you can find us on Jason's absolutely fantastic The Incomparable Network. We are also directly linked to sestracast.com. You can find us on Twitter at sestracast. Gene individually on Twitter is at MacGenie. I am at Mrs. Soup. And Jason is at Jay Snell. Let us know if this was one of your favorite episodes and how you feel. And we'd love to chat with our fans. We'll talk to you later.